Diversity is valued in business and in business schools. An organization that has led the charge to increase representation of African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Native Americans in American business schools and corporate management is the Consortium for Graduate Study in Management. We're going to hear from CGSM's Director of Recruiting in just a minute. I'm Linda Abraham, the founder of Accepted and the host of Admissions Straight Talk, the podcast dedicated to graduate admissions and helping you approach the application process thoughtfully and ultimately successfully. My mission and passion is to help you get to that wonderful moment when you can jump up and down and say, yes, I'm in. I also want to remind you of a new feature on Admissions Straight Talk. We invite your questions. If you have an admissions-related question, just go to the show notes at info.exhibit.com/64, and you will see a widget that will allow you to leave an audio message in which you can ask your question. You can speak using your computer mic or your phone. You can also send me questions via email at questions@accepted.com. If your question is chosen, I'll ask and answer it on the show. This week, I have a question to answer from Graziella. What constitutes a gap in my resume? Should I write an optional essay to explain why I stayed 3 months looking for a new job? Okay, typically, a gap on the resume is right around 3 months. A gap on the resume that requires an explanation would be right around 3 months. If somebody leaves a job and it takes them a month or two to find a new job, I don't think that requires an explanation. But when you get into 3 months, then it starts to raise eyebrows. What were you doing? Why were you doing it? So I would encourage an explanation for a gap in employment of 3 months or more. You could possibly get away without it, but I would really encourage you to do so if you have a good reason for the gap. So what constitutes a good reason? What is a good reason for a gap like that? Where could you actually turn this gap into a positive in your application? Here are a few possibilities. One, you took time to travel for a month or more and visited parts of the world you had never seen before. Two, you decided to use the time to acquire additional skills. Three, you spent several weeks volunteering. Or four, there were extenuating personal circumstances that may have also contributed to the gap. For example, you had to care for an ailing parent or relative or something like that. In any of the above cases, and assuming you don't have lots of additional information to provide in the additional information sections or in an optional essay, provide any of these explanations because it will give the evaluators context for your brief gap between jobs. Again, I don't think 3 months is an inordinate amount. But especially if you use your time well in any of the ways I suggested above, then I think it could actually enhance your chances of acceptance if you provide that explanation. And thank you, Graziella, for the great question. Listeners, please share your questions at info.accepted.com/64, and I'll be happy to answer them. Now to today's guest, Corey Webb. Corey is the Director of Recruiting for the Consortium of Graduate Study in Management. Corey has a bachelor's in architecture from Washington University in St. Louis, but I guess he prefers to build people's careers because in July 2008, he joined the Career Center at WashU as a career development fellow. Then he was the assistant director of the admissions office at WashU, and since 2011, he has served as a director of recruiting for the Consortium for Graduate Study and Management. The consortium is dedicated to enhancing diversity in business education and leadership by helping to reduce the serious underrepresentation of African Americans, Hispanic Americans, and Native Americans in both member schools' enrollments and the ranks of management. CGSM believes this mission can be achieved by recruiting for graduate business education qualified U.S. citizens and U.S. permanent residents who can demonstrate a commitment to the consortium's mission and can best assist the consortium in pursuing that mission. Those are noble goals. Let's explore with Corey how the consortium goes about achieving its aims. Corey, welcome to Admissions Straight Talk. Thanks for joining me.
Hi, Linda. Thanks for having me.
Okay. Can you tell me a little about the consortium's background, how it got started?
Sure. So our organization started in 1966 on the campus of Washington University in St. Louis. At the time, Professor Sterling Shane took a look around and just noticed a severe lack of diversity in MBA programs, but also in the ranks of management. So he pulled together key individuals at the time to have a conversation to determine what is the best way of addressing this challenge. And from those conversations, the consortium was born. The first year, there were about 27 African American males for the first class, just a handful of corporate partners, and then just three schools: Washington University in St. Louis, Indiana University Bloomington, and in the last being University of Wisconsin. But since that time, we've grown greatly. We are although those individuals who can apply, anyone can apply ultimately, but they have to have, of course, a focus toward, the mission of the organization. So there have been changes, but we still have the same focus of increasing diversity in MBA programs.
Great. Now, I know that there are three primary components to how the consortium increases minority represented or underrepresented minority representation at the business schools. There's, first of all, full ride fellowships that cover tuition and fees. And last year, I understand that 380 lucky MBAs got them. And there's also the common simplified application to up to 18 schools. And there is the annual orientation program, also known as OP. And what I'd like to do is just kind of walk through each one, starting with the application, and ask you if you can tell me and our listeners how they work. So let's start with the consortium's common application. What is it, and who is eligible to use it?
Sure. So the common application is great in that it's a time savings and a cost savings.
Right.
So it's a common application in that there's a core application that it's a part of the application that all schools are going to receive. So the things that you will have to fill out multiple times, your name, your education background, your work experience, those particular things, you fill that out once, and that's really the core application. That's what actually goes off to all of the schools that you apply to. And then breaking that down, the next part would be the supplement. And the supplement is really a part of the application that's specific to the individual schools. So if you apply to six schools, you, of course, fill out one core application, but then you have the six individual supplements that you're filling out.
But that would be one essay per school, right?
It's not necessarily one essay per school. It's a number of questions that could range from, a couple of multiple-choice questions with an essay attached to a lot more. It really kind of just depends on ultimately what the school wants to ask. A lot of times, because, of course, you're not applying through their application, you're applying through our application, they use the supplement to make sure they're addressing the same questions that their other applicants are addressing through their application so that, they can figure out, determine your fit for their program against their applicant pool.
Got it. Okay. And you also mentioned that it's much less expensive to apply with a consortium.
Right. It is a cost saving. So it's a sliding scale to apply to through our particular program. So you can apply to one or two schools for $150 or up to six schools for $300. And it is important to know that even though we have 18 different schools that you can apply to, you have to choose up to six schools. So that sliding scale is actually a huge cost savings. I did the math before, and if you were to apply to six of our schools individually through their application process, the amount can be quite costly. It can run up to at least $1,000 or sometimes more. So there's a cost savings there. Mm-hmm. But one of the great things also is that instead of having to send your GRE or your GMAT or whatever, which either test that you take, sending those to the individual schools, which is the cost associated with that as well, too, you send that to us, and you send your transcripts to us as well, too. Ultimately, what we then do is we package up your application, and then we send it off to the school. So it's really kind of what I would consider a one-stop shop.
That's right. That's tremendous savings. Now, can anybody applying to any of those 18 schools use the consortium's application? Or is it just U.S. citizens and permanent residents? Or do you have to support the consortium's mission or have evidence that you support the consortium's mission? What is the eligibility to use the Common App?
Sure. So there are a couple of requirements. The first is that you do have to be a U.S. citizen or a permanent resident, and that's going to be important. And sometimes when it comes to permanent residents, we'll get the question of, I'm currently in this process. I think, I'll be done by the time I'm enrolling in school. What does that look like? What I will say is by the time when you click submit on the application, you want to make sure that the permanent residency status is already completed. And then the second part is that you do have to have a bachelor's degree from an accredited institution.
Mm-hmm.
Those are required. And then the key thing and the part that's really going to be considered for membership to the consortium what I would say is it's going to be how you have demonstrated your support for the mission of the consortium. And for the mission of the consortium, you know, our goal is to increase the number of historically underrepresented minorities in MBA programs and in the ranks of management. And there are many ways of showing that, but there will be parts in the application that will be devoted toward you explaining or having someone else explain on your behalf how you have how you supported the mission of the consortium.
Right. But anybody applying to those schools who's a U.S. resident or U.S. citizen could apply through the consortium, but one of the questions we'll be asking how they support the mission of the consortium. Correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, a couple of specific questions about the application. When is the application going to go live? And have you shrunk the length of the essays or the number of essays required of consortium, not you individually, has the consortium shrunk the length of the essays or the number of essays required for people applying through the consortium?
Sure. So the application will go live in mid-August. We always try and give about a month and a half to 2 months really before the first application deadline for students to go in, start looking at everything, especially, you know, look at those essays and determine exactly, you know, start building their story and what they want to say. And in fact, what we actually do is before we launch our application in mid-August, we actually will take our essays, pull them together, and publish them on our website. And we'll do that in mid-July so that, you know, you can really kind of start working on your essays and what your application is going to look like. And what was your second question, Linda?
The second question was, have you shrunk the length of the essays or the number of essays required?
Sure. And as it relates to the essays, there are certain essays that are in the core application, and then there are essays that are
supplemental
in school. So,
right,
in the supplement. So what I would say is for the core application, those essays are going to be the same. So there is going to be an essay that's focused towards on the mission. So you talking about how you have supported the mission of the consortium. There is going to be an essay that, you know, asks you to explain, you know, why you're taking a step to go into business school. And then there will also be an essay that is ultimately an open-ended essay so that you can explain anything that you'd like to explain or share any information that you felt like you'd like to explain that you may not have had a chance to in other parts of the application.
Mm-hmm. And the length is unchanged on those essays.
Right, yeah. Those lengths are the same.
Okay. So the consortium has not joined the shrink parade in MBA application essays yet. Okay. And next question I have is, now last year the consortium changed its first application deadline from November 15th, where it had been for years, to October 15th. May I ask why?
So really what we want to do is just give students who are applying what I really should say, I think probably the best way of explaining this is, yeah, if you look in the MBA application process world and you look at individual school processes, yeah, there are decision deadlines that happen far earlier than our October deadline, and there are some that happen, of course, later than our January 5th. So what our goal was to do was to really kind of adapt what our two particular processes deadlines were to kind of give a little bit more room so that people who were applying earlier in the process could also apply to the consortium earlier, and then if they're applying later in the process, they, of course, still have the January 5th deadline. And it's really just to give this opportunity for those individuals who get started early, know where they want to go, and they know that they want to get that application in, have the opportunity to go ahead and get it in, which then, of course, allows schools to get their application earlier, which could be very nice because in our process, the admissions decision is, of course, made by the schools, and the earlier they get the application, the earlier the opportunity for them to actually offer them admission, and, of course, for that student to determine, you know, if that school is the best fit and if they'd like to enroll.
Right. And I think there's been, certainly since I've been doing this, which is 20 years now, there has been a move with those round one deadlines to move them earlier. When I first, you know, in the late 90s, even early 2000s, most of the round one deadlines were the end of October, mid and end of October, and now they're creeping into mid-September. So there's clearly been a change over the last 10-15 years. Now, the fellowships is probably the most exciting part of your offerings, and one great way to increase representation of underrepresented groups. What are the criteria for earning or being awarded one of the consortium fellowships, and what are the responsibilities of consortium fellows? Got to get that word out.
So in terms of criteria, so there are a couple of things to note. And I always like to break down the process in three specific steps because the fellowship aspect is the very last step. So first, you apply to the consortium, and the first step that has to happen is you have to be admitted to the school. And that decision, of course, does lay with the schools. You have to, even though you're applying through us, we always say you have to make yourself competitive. So you want to connect with them, let them know you're interested. On top of that, do the research, determine kind of what you need to do to position yourself to be competitive in their particular process. So after you're admitted to a school, we then have the opportunity to take a look at your application, determine your fit for the consortium. So we're trying to make a decision on membership. After someone has been admitted to a school, and then we make the decision to approve them for membership or to offer them membership, it then goes back to the school to offer a fellowship. And the fellowship is important to note that even though it's labeled the consortium fellowship, it does come from our individual schools. So one thing that we always encourage is to have that conversation with the schools to determine exactly what they're looking for, but also at minimum just to note that, of course, you do have to be a member of the consortium or to be approved for membership before you can be considered for a fellowship. And I should also mention that the fellowship covers full tuition plus required fees at schools. So it's not the complete cost, but it is a huge chunk of the cost of what MBA studies is. So I always say, for example, if over 2 years you're spending $100,000, not only in terms of tuition, but also in terms of living expenses or anything else like that, because it covers full tuition plus required fees, that could be 70 to 80% of your cost.
Sure.
But, things like cost of living and travel expenses and things like that, you have to cover. But it's still a huge cost saving.
Absolutely. And the cost of living you'd have regardless of whether you were in school or you were working. That's just
right,
part
right.
of life is the cost of living. And it's expensive. I just, if you have 380 fellowships and 18 schools, the math would work out that you have approximately 21 fellowships per school. Is it that evenly divided, or do some schools have more fellowships, and how does that part of it work?
No, that's a really good question. Really, the way it works, because if you look at our consortium schools, we have 18 different schools, and we actually have 19 programs. We actually have one school that offers two programs, both the two-year program and one-year program. Of course,
okay.
All of our 18 schools offer two-year programs. But the way it works is that a school will make a decision to ultimately offer the fellowship. But we have some much larger schools, and we have some much smaller schools. So oftentimes we'll see for the smaller schools, there might be less fellowships. There might be, of course, a smaller incoming class. But for our larger schools, we have a much larger fellowship offers and out on the table, as well as a much larger class. So it kind of scales to the size of the school and the size of the MBA program.
Okay. So it's not even across the board, obviously.
Right.
Finally, OP, the orientation program. What is it, and why do people rave about it?
I could probably talk for an hour or 2 hours, but in the interest of time, I'll pull some key points about orientation program.
Okay.
So orientation program is a great program. To paint a picture, imagine a whole incoming class, and this year we actually had our largest incoming class yet. We're at around 420, which we're very excited about. It's a record.
Congratulations. That's great.
So, thank you very much. So we're shooting even higher for next year. So
all right.
420 students that came in for this particular year. We have our 70-ish corporate partners that come in also as well, too. And then we have all of our member schools. They all converge on one city. This was last year. It was Austin, Texas. And really what it is it's a time to help students prepare to be successful not only in the MBA program for their 1 year or 2 years that they're actually in their program, but also to be prepared to be ready to start interviewing for internships and to secure job opportunities for the future. So for the first couple of days, a lot of it is centered around not only getting to know your classmates and the incoming complete consortium class, but also yourself. It also helps students better understand the opportunities that are going to be available for them. So, for example, If an individual is coming into an MBA program and they're changing industry, they're interested in maybe consulting or they're interested in, you know, corporate finance or some type of industry, they might have an interest in it, but they may not have explored exactly what it means. One of the great things about our program is it allows you to really explore and delve into it. So when you walk into school, you know, that very first day, you have really a leg up compared to the individuals who are not consortium because you've been able to explore and better understand what happens, you know, in those
different directions. Sure.
Also, yeah, and on top of that, I think I'd like to point out that for the orientation program, we also start delving into topics that are going to be important in business, not only at the level of being in school, but also at the level of once you graduate and once you become a manager or get into the C-suite or wherever you go, such as diversity in business and kind of where it is and what's happening and what's the trend that's happening in that particular field. Or, for example, something else that I think is important is ethics in business. You know, as you're making business decisions, whether it's your own business or you're a representative for another business, you've got to think about the ethics of it. And, you know, those are the kind of conversations that happen early. And then I would also say is at the very end of orientation program, it culminates in a career forum where for about 3 to 4 hours, our corporate partners, they have booths. They're talking to you. You're engaging them. And you're talking about your interest in their particular companies and ultimately securing internship offers or sometimes just securing interviews that will later turn into internship offers.
That's fantastic.
And then the final day is, yeah, and then I would say the final day is as people are getting on flights or whatnot, we actually have people who are sitting there interviewing. And I actually remember this year that I was talking to some people who I got to know because I see names come across my screen for a full complete cycle, and then I start putting faces in names, and, you know, they're talking about how they were preparing for, you know, 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 interviews. And these are the initial interviews that ultimately do convert into, you know, internship offers. So that's a snapshot of orientation program.
That's fantastic. And internships obviously frequently convert into the full-time job. So it sounds wonderful. And it's so important. This is something that I emphasize in my work, that people arrive on campus at the beginning of the MBA program with a fairly clear idea of what kind of internship they want to get. This is why I also emphasize the importance of really having career direction for the post-MBA. Because you don't have the time when you arrive on campus to start figuring it out. The internship, A, you're going to be inundated with work and with all the opportunities that a top MBA program provides. And internship recruiting starts almost immediately. And that internship is critical to getting the long-term job. So the thinking and the initial connections, it's just a wonderful opportunity. And then, of course, if somebody does have a leg up on the internship search, they can focus more on their classwork and the extracurricular opportunities that are available at top business schools. So it does sound wonderful.
And I think, you know, also something else I'd like to point out, too, is
sure.
One of the great things is having that connection, you know, early with the consortium's orientation program. A lot of our students are, you know, they're members of National Black or they're members of Neshimba. So what you'll see is they'll meet a corporate partner early on before anyone else gets that opportunity to, and then they reengage them at National Black or they reengage them as Neshimba. And as those touch points happen, all of a sudden, you know, they're the level of I guess how competitive they are in that application process, of course, increases. So, and that's just another level of what the orientation program does. That's kind of inadvertent, but it does happen that way.
Right. Now, I saw that the OP is open to consortium students. Are consortium students those who received the CGSM fellowship? I thought those were the fellows. Or are they the people who applied via the consortium? How are they defined? In other words, who is eligible to attend OP?
Sure. So what we do is we call all of our incoming class, their consortium fellows. So of our 420 students that came through for this past application year, they're all consortium fellows.
So they're all people who got the fellowship, right?
So they're not all that – they did not all receive consortium fellowship.
Okay.
Our incoming class we call consortium fellows, but, you know, about 60 to 70% of them actually received that consortium fellowship, which is a full tuition plus required fees a fellowship. So that's a great question. There is that difference, but one of the key things is for the 420 students, that whole incoming class, they still have access to all the resources the consortium has, from orientation program to our CGSM online, which is the way that our corporate partners engage our students when they aren't there kind of at the orientation program. So they still have all the same resources and engagement opportunities. The only difference is that 60 or 70% actually have a fellowship attached to their offer.
I got it. So you can apply through the consortium, but you may not be accepted to the consortium class, and you can be accepted to the consortium class and you may and be called a fellow, but you may not have the scholarship. Is that am I understanding you correctly? So it's kind of like a concentric circles, if you will, right? Different levels of support. Okay. Now, when consortium students earn their MBA, do they also graduate from the consortium? Is their relationship with the consortium over, or does it continue, and how does it change?
Sure. So the relationship with the consortium is a lifetime relationship. You go through your This is how I always like to say. I say that one of the great things about being a member of the consortium is that not only do you have the opportunity of having a network of your school, so, you know, you go to that school for 2 years, you graduate, you still have that alumni network, but you also have the same type of opportunity with the consortium. So you have two powerful networks that you can really tap into that can, you know, help drive you in success. So for us, once you are enrolled as a student, we actually transfer over to someone who manages our student and alumni relationship. And it doesn't stop there. On campus, our students are extremely active. We actually have student liaisons, and it's 2 to 3 individuals on each campus that really manages that relationship between us and the students, and really the community as well, too, because our students are so active as well. And actually, you know, for any prospective student out there, I would say go on our website, definitely look at the student, you know, connect with the student liaisons, ask them about, you know, their experience, because that's really what they're there for. But at the point, you know, after you graduate, the relationship is still there. We ask that they're constantly, you know, supporting the mission of the consortium. And there are many ways of doing that. And one of the best ways that we see is that our alumni will come back to orientation program. They'll participate sitting on panels as, you know, vice presidents or presidents or CEOs of companies and talking about their experience. But on top of that, they also are spreading the word. I think that word of mouth is one of the best ways of finding out about the consortium. You know, so many students I'll ask, how did you find out about us? And they said, well, there's a current student, or, you know, there's an alum who, you know, they went to the consortium, or, you know, my father did it, and he told me I have to think about this. So it is that point where we now get legacy. So, but that kind of gives you an idea of, of what that responsibility looks like. Yeah.
So that clearly is a lifelong relationship then. Yeah. What about non-MBA management programs? You know, either part-time, EMBA, specialized master's degrees. Are students pursuing those graduate management educations eligible for the fellowships or for the OP, for the orientation program?
Sure. So at this time, we're only individuals who are looking for two-year programs at one of our 18 schools or one-year program at Emory, which is the one school that offers the one-year program, can apply. Right now, we do not offer application or membership to individuals who are looking at anything outside of that full-time two-year or that one-year program.
Got it. Now, Cornell also has an accelerated program. I believe it's a member school. Am I mistaken there? Or
It is a member school. However, right now they are on board as a two-year full-time program.
Got it. Okay. Now, Accepted has hosted online chats with the consortium for years, and one question was asked at, I think, every single chat we hosted for the consortium. Students are asked to rank the schools that they are applying to in order of interest in that program. Why, and do the schools see those rankings? Because those rankings cause a lot of anxiety.
Yes, and that is a question that I, along with the rest of my recruiting team, will get on the road, and of course in the office as well too. So let me explain that a little bit. So in the application process, there is a point in time where we ask you to rank your schools 1 through 6. And how does that? What is that used in? So the only time that ranking is used is going to be in the fellowship selection process. It's not used in the admissions process. It's only in the fellowship selection process. In the fellowship selection process, the way that we offer a consortium fellowship is we do it by really what's equivalent to a draft. So your first choice of school has the opportunity to offer you a fellowship. If they choose to offer you the fellowship, then 2nd through 6th do not have that opportunity. However, if the first choice school chooses to forego giving you a fellowship, then your second choice school has the opportunity to. And of course, once you come off the table, once a school offers you a fellowship, then the schools that are ranked lower than them will not have the opportunity to offer you another fellowship. So I think there's a couple of key points to bring from there. A is that there is only one consortium fellowship offer. So you can get a consortium fellowship offer from, you know, Emory, or a fellowship offer from Cornell or from NYU, but you don't get a consortium fellowship offer from multiple schools. Mm-hmm. It's also important to know that, and what we encourage people to do is to also talk to the schools, make sure that you apply for all different types of financial aid opportunities, because even though we have individuals who will come and they'll attend and they'll be consortium members, and they may not have gotten the consortium fellowship, but there might be some other fellowship opportunity at the school they did qualify for that might be, you know, just as good. It could be a full ride. So that does happen. And then the third thing that I think is really important to take away is that you want to make sure that you do the research on the front end so that you rank your schools and you know exactly what school you want to have the first opportunity to offer you the fellowship. Because I will say, Linda, I do get this this call sometimes. You know, it's I would say March, or it's right probably February, March time, you know. Someone's been on campus, they went on for maybe a diversity weekend or something of that sort. They submit their application before they visited it, and they pick up the phone and say, oh, I love this school. I really like to make it my number one choice school. Right now it's number three or four. What can I do for you? I mean, what you know, can I make that change? Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the answer is after you submit your application, it is final. So we do encourage you to put the time into the front end, visit, make sure you know that rankings 1 through 6 is exactly the ranking of order of schools that you want.
Yeah. And do the schools see the ranking before they're actually considering fellowship decisions? Do they see it in the admissions process, or is it something that they only have access to when it comes to fellowships?
So schools do see the rankings throughout the whole process, including the admissions process. Mm-hmm. But what I will say is that the schools, they're clamoring for the talent. Just as our core partners are clamoring for talent for orientation program, our schools are clamoring for those students who are good fits to be part of their a member of their program. So whether you rank a school first or you rank a school sixth, if they want you, they're going to admit you. And then, you know, they'll have more specific conversations and look at ways of actually yielding you. And we do have individuals who will pass up, you know, their first or second choice school because that third or fourth choice school really appealed to them after they visited and after they were able to talk about financial aid opportunities and things of that nature.
Now, obviously, if you, let's say you apply to 6 consortium schools, just for, as a hypothetical, and you're accepted by your first, third, and fifth school in terms of your ranking, so then it would be, the first school would have the opportunity to offer you a fellowship. If they decline to do so, then I guess the third school would have the option of offering the fellowship. Do I understand correctly the process?
Yes, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Okay, great. And then you worked as an admissions officer, and now you're director of recruiting at the consortium. Do you have any last advice for MBA applicants about to apply or considering applying via the consortium?
Sure, definitely. You know, I would say it's never too early to start the application process. I think that you want to give yourself time to plan and prepare. There are some things that are set in stone, such as, you know, you've got your undergraduate career, that's complete. You can always take class on top of that, but the undergraduate career is complete. So there's some things that you really can't change, but there are some things that you can affect and you can actually make changes to if you want to. And those are going to be your GMAT and your GRE scores. That's going to be key. And, of course, who you pick for your recommenders. So I would say, you know, really plan out the process. Take the time, lay it out, and make sure that you give yourself plenty of time to be successful. I get people that will contact me well in advance, you know, 3, 4, 5 months in advance. And I have no problems with that, because what that tells me is that person is really being methodical about what's happening. But then I'll also have individuals who will contact me after the date, or the deadline. And that can be a little bit of a challenge because they're rushing to get their essays down. They're rushing to get a recommender together. And, of course, that's something that's not really in your wheelhouse. You have to talk to someone and make sure that they can fill out the recommendation on your behalf and do a great job and have the time to do it. So I would say the planning process is going to be the biggest thing. And then I would also say that make sure that you put in the research, that you take the time to do the research, and that you connect with admissions representatives so that when that piece of paper comes across the desk and it's your application, it's not just an application. If you've connected with them and they can almost, you know, associate a name with a face, all of a sudden it's an individual. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So. Mm-hmm. That's great advice. Thank you so much. Corey, thank you again for taking the time to speak with me. You're actually one of the few Admission Straight Talk guests whom I've actually met in person. So I have an image of you as we're speaking, and it's been a pleasure speaking with you and learning more about the consortium. I'm sorry to say that we're out of time. Where can listeners learn more about your work and the Consortium for the Graduate Study of Management?
Sure, absolutely. I would say that, you know, go to our website. It's www.cgsm.org. There's a lot of information. We actually just did a complete redesign of our website about a year ago, and there's so much information out there under the Prospective Student tab. I would definitely say, you know, fill out an interest page, which gets you on our mailing list. But then on top of that, we are in major cities across the nation. In fact, we just rolled out our recruiting calendar. So if you are in those cities, or if you're, you know, an hour drive away, definitely take the time. They're about three to five hour events, depending on what event it is. Come out, talk to us, find out more about us, but also, you know, connect with the admissions representatives as well too.
Okay, great. So we'll include links in the show notes at info.accepted.com/64 to cgsm.org, and where, listener, you can learn more and in greater depth about the consortium. And Corey, if you send me a link when your essay questions go live to the essay questions, I understand that's going to happen before the application actually goes live, we'll also include a link to that in the show notes.
Okay.
Okay. So, listener, thank you, too, for joining Corey and me for our 64th episode. If you found this episode valuable, please share the good word. We've made it really easy for you to do so. Just go to info.accepted.com/love. You'll find there an already drafted tweet that you can send to your Twitter followers, or you can copy and paste it into a Facebook or LinkedIn update. And thanks in advance for doing so. You can also leave a review on iTunes or Stitcher. 5 stars are particularly appreciated, but we'll take feedback, whatever it is. If you feel we deserve the 5 stars, we're happy to have them. And if you have a question for me, please ask it at info.accepted.com/64 or by sending an email to questions@accepted.com. Thanks again for coming. This is Admission Straight Talk, produced by Accepted, and I am your host, Linda Abraham. I'll talk to you again next week.
Our theme music is provided by podcastthemes.com.